This is KWAI, Honolulu, 1080 on the AM dial.
Mr. Miles Davis here on K108, 1080 on the AM dial. It's 8 minutes, coming up on 8 minutes after the hour of 8 o'clock. It's a Sunday. It's time once again for the Carol Cox Show. And this morning, Carol has a special guest in the studio. It's Ed Case. And we'll know more about Ed Case. And if you have questions for Carol or Ed, number here is 524-1080. Now here's Carol Cox.
Hey, good morning. Thank you, Francis. Good morning, everybody out there. And thank you, Mr. Ed Case, for coming in. Actually, the last minute, in the last couple of days, I contacted you and asked you to come in. And the reason is that we here at this show, we try to bring and talk about a little politics. We dabble, I should say. And we talk about being smart voters, and I express my opinions, and sometimes as warped as they are, what have you. But I thought I would seize this opportunity and ask you to come in and be available to the listeners out there who has great opinions, and I thought maybe by inviting you, they could have a direct, unscripted opportunity to speak with you and hopefully the other candidates out there. I'll extend the invite as I have Mr. Case here, who quickly accepted it. So all of you out there, 524-1080, you can speak with Mr. Ed Case, former congressman, served us in what district did you serve for us?
I served in the 2nd Congressional District. Hawaii is split up into two districts, and the 1st Congressional is Honolulu proper, and then the 2nd is the rest of the state. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for having me on. First of all, I appreciate it. Any show that starts with Miles Davis is probably going to be a good show.
Yeah, I hope so. And we got some really sharp listeners out there. We can't see them here, but I'm surprised. I go home and I see 19,000 hits in 1 month, and then it's kicking up and ticking every week, 3,000-4,000. So, and then the live listeners, some that don't have the internet or have the time. But I want to ask you, what is your background? We know that you served us earlier, but what is your background?
Sure, thanks for asking that. Well, I was born and raised over in Hilo on the Big Island. I grew up there. My family has been in Hawaii since the late 1800s, and I had a kind of a classic rural neighbor island upbringing in Hilo. I went to the public schools and the private schools over there, and when I graduated, I went to a college, Williams College, Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. And when I got out of Williams College, I didn't know what I wanted to do with the rest of my life, so I went down to Washington, D.C. to work as a summer intern for a couple of months, just thinking that it would be a good thing to do. I worked for then U.S. Congressman Spark Matsunaga, who was my predecessor in the job that I then took decades later. And I loved it right from the beginning, believed in public service, liked really the approach that he followed, and that became kind of my life. I went on to law school in the University of California. Came back here to Hawaii and practiced law and have practiced law for most of the last 30 years. I ran for the state legislature and served Manoa in the state legislature for 8 years, 1994 to 2002. 2002, I ran for governor in that year. Just lost out in the primary by a little bit less than 1%.
Mm-hmm.
And then the late, great Patsy Mink passed away after the primary, and I ran for her seat in Congress. Was elected, served out the rest of that term, served two full terms in the Congress, and then ran for the U.S. Senate in 06, and Senator Akaka stayed in office that year. And I came home, and I've been practicing law and continuing in public service since.
Well, I might add that in my efforts in the past years in dealing with your office as a legislator and as well as in Congress, you're quite receptive and responsive. So I want to thank you for that. As
I believe in that. I really do believe in that. A lot of politicians give it a little bit of lip service. Mm-hmm. I have always believed right from the get-go, and this goes back to the Spark Matsunaga days, because he really believed in that too, and he taught me and many, many others that your obligation is to your constituents, and you try to help them. If they need a tour of Washington, you help them with that. If they need access to a federal program, you help them with that. If they just need some information, you help them with that. If they write you or email you, you respond, because that's the least you can do. That was really, I remember him saying that many, many times, so I believe in that.
And that's a great complaint that we receive. Our local and federal legislators don't respond to us, and timely, or when they do, it's the matter that they were interested in is gone.
Well, it's become a lot tougher because, especially with the advent of email and all kinds of electronic communications, the volume of communications you receive has grown exponentially. But I always believed that we needed to try to keep up with that, and as my former staff know, I was a real stickler for who's writing and how long it's taking to get something back to them and getting something back to everybody. Because if you go through the effort to contact your congressman, you deserve a response. And I forget what the figure was, but I think we got somewhere in the range of 200,000 inquiries and responses in the course of 4 years. So that'll tell you a little bit about the volume.
Wow. While you served there in Washington, what were some of your most memorable or accomplishments, I should say, and ask follow-up is, what were your disappointments?
Sure. I would kind of break it down. I felt very, very good, first of all, about the 4 years that I spent in Congress. I think we accomplished a great deal, and the areas, obviously, of concern then and now, were the economy, the federal budget, education, health care, foreign policy, environmental protection, the safety net. Those items don't really fade away. Sometimes they're more acute and sometimes they're less acute, but they always are the concern of government, and so we definitely dealt in all of those areas. I would say these are just a couple of the areas that, as I look back on my 4 years, I feel particularly good about. One is, I guess, what we call a more procedural, or more the relationship between government and the people that it represents. I believe, and still do believe, passionately in outreach. I don't think it's enough just for somebody to email you or write you and for you to give them a response. I believe in uncensored, direct, unmoderated communication with your constituents where they live and work.
Right.
So that means you go to them. And this goes back again to my Matsunaga days, because Spark said something that stuck with me ever since, which is that when you are out in the community with your constituents, you are the government. You are their government. And
right.
That may be one of the only times in their entire life that they have any communication with their federal government. They've been paying taxes all of their life. They've looked to their federal government to assist them. Washington, D.C. is a long way away. It's 5,000 miles away.
Mm-hmm.
You get somebody in most places in Honolulu, it's a difficult, or Hawaii, it's a difficult process to go to Washington and see your federal government. So when your congressman is back, that's your government.
Mm-hmm.
And I believed and believe in reaching out into the communities. So what I did was I started and maintained throughout my time in Congress a series of talk stories. I call them talk stories, community meetings, where I would go out personally on the rounds, really, throughout my district. And And you know, like I said, some of these places in my district, they'd never seen a congressman. They'd never been close to a congressman or a senator, for that matter. Hardly even their state legislator sometime. I did about 200 of those throughout 4 years in Congress. That's about 50 a year. You figure about one a week. Of course, I condensed them up. And I really felt that those were incredibly valuable, both for the people that I represented, but also for me. Because I got to just absorb. You know, when you get to Washington, there's kind of this, you know, cloud that descends over you, a bubble that descends over you that's called, you know, the inside and outside the beltway. And it is seductive, I should say, one way would be to say it, to just kind of start to not listen to what's happening in the rest of the country. And there's only, because everybody in Washington is talking to each other, it's kind of an incestuous place. And you can easily deceive yourself into feeling that what the discussion is what people are really concerned about out in the constituency that we represent. So for me, it was invaluable to get that one-on-one. And, you know, not to say it isn't difficult. I mean, you get plenty of times when people stand up and yell at you and scream at you and, you know, say things that are a little unnice. But that's all right. I think that was valuable. So that's number one. Number two, I guess, in terms of some of the specific issues I focused on, certainly I was concerned about the federal budget very, very much then, and of course that's magnified today. One of the things that I'm most proud of, though, is that I had a pretty central part in the creation of the Northwestern Hawaiian Islands, now National Historic Monument, Papahana Mokuakea. And this is a bill that I introduced into Congress during my tenure that really kind of laid out the path for what eventually the president, to his great credit, did administratively. And I worked kind of behind the scenes with the administration to get that done because it was really kind of a circuitous and difficult path, fraught with a lot of dangers and opposition along the way. But we pulled it off, and I really feel good about that.
Well, you know, the speaking of the National Sanctuary, the Marine Sanctuary, one of the things that comes to the forefront, and that is, we'll talk about other issues facing the U.S. and facing the state, but I deal with a lot of the fishing industry locally, and it seems that if you were going back to Congress, what is it that you could do? Food quality, for example. We have a good product, per se, and rare that I would say this, but we have HACCP compliance. The fishing boats are regulated. We're probably the best regulated in the nation or in the world, per se, when it comes to endangered species. And could be some improvements left to be done here, but I see dealing with the fishing industry now, the public's food quality and the safety is jeopardized by the importation of tainted foods, CO2, carbon monoxide, and what have you. What could you do, or would you take that upon to
absolutely
aid the local fishermen?
Yeah, very much. I mean, and I did work on that actually during my time in Congress because you know, the fishing industry is obviously a very important industry here that we don't want to die, and they face a lot of competition from foreign fishers, some of it legitimate competition and some of it, frankly, illegal competition, because those fishers are fishing in places they shouldn't fish and because they are not complying with their own regulations. And I think we all know that, in general, one of the disadvantages our country has is that we actually care about some of these things, and we try to create standards and enforce them. And if other countries are not having the same standards, If they have a lower quality requirement, if they have a lower catch requirement, higher catch requirement, these things lead to what I view as unfair competition, and they disadvantage an industry that's trying to comply. So from the federal perspective, the challenge is number one, because this is a federal regulatory kuleana.
Right.
So from the first level is, are the regulations fair? Do they do the job? Are they not so onerous that they essentially kill an industry that doesn't really do the job for anybody? And I don't think we've quite found the right balance in our federal regulations of food quality, fish catches, all of the other things that our local fishermen have to take care of. The second area is kind of international relations, which is, are you going to get other countries to comply with reasonable requirements also? Because if they don't comply, their fish shouldn't be coming in here
right
at all.
Mm-hmm.
If you comply, fair enough.
Yeah, well, we are seeing that, for example, the National Marine Fisheries Service in their food industry, or seafood industry office, they actually regulate and certify facilities that if you were to go and check them on the Food and Drug Administration import site, you'd see that these certified facilities are sending in materials that are being rejected by the container loads from these plants. And so I think Congress or somewhere up there needs to step in, and I hope that, you know, in the future.
Part of the problem is, and you find this repeatedly throughout the federal government, but part of the problem is you have, jurisdictions that cross over boundaries all of the time.
Mm-hmm.
I could give you numerous examples of how too many departments are in the soup for one particular industry or issue, and you've got to kind of centralize. I remember trying to deal, for example, with the issue of visa waivers from Asia in order to facilitate greater travel and tourism from Asia. And you would think you could just go to one department and try to sort that out. No, you've got to go to the Department of State, the Department of Commerce, the Department of Homeland Security, and you've got to get them all lined up on the same page. And actually, this was a challenge that we had with the Northwestern Hawaiian Islands. We had to get various agencies and departments lined up and pulling in one direction. They had different mandates. See, that was one of the problems. I mean, you know, one agency had the mandate of protecting the Northwestern Hawaiian Islands. Another agency had the mandate of utilizing them for commercial purposes. And, you know, it's kind of hard to have your cake and eat it, too. If you can, great. If you can't, mm-hmm. you've got to make a call, which is what we did.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, issues, speaking in that same vein, what important issues you think are facing the nation? As I said earlier, and also the state, if you would speak to that.
Well, I think we all have to acknowledge that the economy, jobs, the protection of our financial ability to live, those issues are all going to be number one for some time yet. This is not going to be some recession that comes and goes, and, you know, 6 months from now we're not going to be thinking about it. Unfortunately, this is a longer-term, deeper, broader systemic downturn that we have to deal with at the federal level, and we will have to continue to deal with at the federal level. So there's no question in my mind that the single number one issue that we all have to deal with, and that I believe I need to deal with if I am elected as Hawaii's next congressman, is to deal with stabilizing, revitalizing our national economy, creating jobs, maintaining jobs, assuring that people can continue to pay for their houses and their medical care and their kids' education and all those kind of things. That's number one. Has to be number one. A close number two, which when I was in Congress previously, several of us were crying in the wilderness about, but has now come to the forefront, is our national budget, our federal budget.
Mm-hmm.
That was on an unsustainable course then, and in the last couple of years, we've seen it deteriorate tremendously. And that we have to balance our books, because if we don't balance our books, we won't be able to pay for these programs that we need down the road. We won't be able to maintain a good economy. We won't hand this government off to our children the way we got it, as we want. And all of those issues, those are really the two big issues. Now, there are obviously other issues that today are very, very much predominant, whether it be health care reform or some of our foreign policy challenges. But I'd say those two are number one.
Mm-hmm. Now, here in the state, you having been a representative here, and you have some idea, the polls showed, recent Honolulu Advertiser polls showed you 56% leading the pack, and the others are 22. Senator Hanabusa was at 22%, and then others were 21%. What do you attribute this high rating or ranking or the preference of the voters toward you? What would you?
Well, I think I'm very grateful for that first. And the second thing I would say right off the bat is that we've got a long campaign in front of us. So that's a snapshot of where the campaign is today and what the voters might do if the election was held today. But, you know, the election is not going to be held today. It's going to be held next September. So,
but do you think that your past accomplishments and
contributions... Yeah, there's no question. I mean, when I was both a state legislator for 8 years and a U.S. congressman for over 4 years, I approached problems directly, frontally, candidly.
Mm-hmm.
I proposed solutions that were sometimes controversial. I tried not to get stuck in partisan politics or petty politics. I tried to listen to everybody, whether they were powerful or not. I took on the powerful on occasion. And I tried to follow a certain belief that I have as to how a legislator should approach a consensus-based, solution-based, but you got to get things done. And I applied that throughout 8 years in Congress, in the state legislature and over four in Congress. And I think people want that in government today. That's number one. And then number two, I think people get that I will retain my seniority if I go back to Congress. So I'll be a four-plus year.
Mm-hmm.
Member of Congress. Congressman Abercrombie is leaving. He's got 20 years of seniority, and that's going to create a huge puka on the U.S. House of Representatives side for Hawaii. Now, if I can pick up with four-plus years of experience of seniority and another 3 years of experience as a staff member, you know, I don't have to learn the ropes. I mean, I'm going to hit the ground running from day one. I think people appreciate that. They understand the value of that. So I think that's probably what attributes that. Now, obviously, my opponents are going to try to say that that's all irrelevant, and I'm going to say it's very, very relevant. But
yeah, I would think it would be a grave mistake if they were to state that. The voters are sharper than that, and they know how difficult these times are, and it's not a time to just send somewhat a fresh men, so to speak, up there, because these are tough times, and the money that is available, every state in the nation is struggling for it and clawing for it, and cutbacks and you know, high deficits. So
I think the third thing, maybe if I could just supplement a little bit, is that the issues that we need to address in our U.S. government now, in our Congress, are the issues that I've worked on and worked in throughout my entire career. So, you know, the economy, I've been in the private sector, hardcore private sector, for 30 years, federal budgets, I've managed private companies. I've worked on state and federal budgets, foreign relations, which is key. I've always made that number one for me as well. So,
okay, this is the Carol Cox Show. You can call in 524-1080. My guest is Mr. Ed Case, congressional candidate. We have a caller. Pam, are you there? Good morning. How are you?
Yes, hi. Mr. Case, I just wanted to say that I think it's great that you're coming on the show. I'm a producer with our local community television here, and we did a program on invasive species, and the act that Mr. Abercrombie had introduced, co-sponsored. And we asked for just a 15-minute interview, either in person or over the phone, and he is running for governor of the state, and he refused to even provide us with that. And we realize we're no big thing being community television, but we do bring things to the people. So I wanted to congratulate you on that. But my question is, in reading a little bit about Woodrow Wilson and the Federal Reserve Bank, in his book, The New Freedom, I just want to read one thing. If you had stated that stabilizing the national economy and balancing our books was of the utmost importance, which I agree, but I'd like to get your reaction to Woodrow Wilson's statement. A great industrial nation is controlled by its system of credit. Our system of credit is privately concentrated. The growth of the nation, therefore, and all our activities are in the hands of a few men. We have come to be one of the worst ruled, one of the most completely controlled and dominated governments in the civilized world. No longer a government by free opinion, no longer a government by conviction and the vote of the majority, but a government by the opinion and the duress of a small group of dominant men. Would you please give us your views on the Federal Reserve Bank and stabilizing the national economy?
Thank you very much, and I really can't. I don't know why Representative Abercrombie would have declined the invite. I think he's usually pretty good at trying to get out there as well. And by the way, I'd love to talk about invasive species as well, because that was an area that I very much focused on when I was in Congress. representing the invasive species capital of probably our country, if not our world. Let me try to answer your question more broadly. Let me state up front that I do believe in private enterprise, and I do believe in the private system of running and administering economic activity. I think that if we look at the history of our world to date, we will see that where government has gotten too involved, even supplanting private business, that has not worked. On the other hand, I think we can all probably look back over history and see glaring instances both in our country and around the world where if we simply said, as one of our presidents famously said, that the business of government is business, that's not going to work also. There needs to be a balance. There needs to be a check and balance on the excesses of private business. And we have seen this in spades over the last a couple of years, when essentially I don't think anybody can doubt that our current recession was at least triggered and worsened and deepened by a failure of the private capital markets to self-police themselves, and that was also, by the way, a failure of our federal government to regulate them adequately. Both our Congress and our president at the time and our federal executive administrative bodies. So the challenge for me always is finding that right balance between too much and too little regulation, because too much regulation is going to shut down an economy, and too little regulation is also going to shut down an economy eventually. Now, I think the Federal Reserve is not, quote-unquote, the bad guy in all of this. I have to say that to you up front. I think it's done a lot of good in terms of trying to maintain credit, maintaining reasonable checks on inflation, all of the other areas that it has to worry about from a macroeconomic perspective. The issue is whether what you said at the beginning is true, which is just a few people are running the show and the heck with everybody else. I think that's been true in portions of our history, and I think that depends very, very much on the involvement of the American people in the political process. When you have voting down at 50%, you're obviously going to start to turn over the control and reins of government to a very, very small group, and that's been one of the consequences lately, and I think we saw in our last presidential elections that people were pretty much fed up with that, and so we saw an uptick in voting. What I fear is that we will now go in the other direction and that we will start to see it tick down again, and that is when you will start to see over-centralizations of power in both Congress and our federal government. We can't afford that.
Okay. That answers Pam's?
I still have tremendous concerns about the Federal Reserve Bank, and I wish that all your listeners out there would just Google and do a little research on the Federal Reserve Bank. I think that's why our nation is crippled in debt, and I appreciate your remarks, Mr. Gates, and I do thank you for them.
Pam, I would say that on the debt front, our nation is crippled in debt because our Congress and our presidents have not balanced the books. They have spent more than they were bringing in, and they have basically pushed that debt off to future generations. So I really, with respect, can't lay that one off to the feds or any particular part of government. I was in Congress for 4 years when we repeatedly supported large increases in our annual deficits and in our overall debt, and that's got to stop. We don't, we have to balance our books.
Okay. I agree with you, Mr. Kate. I just hope your Carol's listeners will do their research.
Okay. Well, thank you. Barbara got a call from Barbara, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Thank
and
you.
Where are you calling from?
I'm on Maui.
Okay. Is that your...
I was very happy to represent Maui in the 2nd Congressional District, and Maui is not in the 1st Congressional District, mm-hmm. but one thing I want to say before I take the question is that from the perspective of representing Hawaii in the U.S. House of Representatives, functionally, we are both at-large representatives. I didn't not represent people in the first or issues in the first because I represented the second, and certainly if I become the representative from the first, I'm going to look forward to continuing to represent Maui and the rest of the second.
Mm-hmm. Barbara, you got a question for Mr. Case?
Well, yes. I'm very concerned about animal cruelty And we've been doing demonstrations in Maui. And I know they're going to be doing some in Oahu, too, about in foie gras, which is a very cool dish. Well, they serve it in a lot of restaurants, importing disease. Oh, well, it's force-fed duck. It's like a...
So what now is your question for Mr. Case?
Well, I know that economy is a big issue, but what is your opinion about pursuing better laws for animal cruelty in Hawaii?
Right, I very much support stronger laws, and I don't think the laws are adequate as they stand today. And I think the other thing to note is that times and beliefs and approaches also change. I mean, foie gras may have been, you know, okay marginally, I guess, in the times 50 years ago, but it's pretty hard to start to justify it, in the world that we live in today. I think that, this is an area that you try to find the right balance also between federal and state laws. And I know that this has been a big issue, a huge issue in our state legislature, as it should be. And by the way, as it was when I was serving in the state legislature from 94 to 02, when I, as I recall, did co-introduce stronger animal cruelty laws along with other fellow legislators. I think we could make the argument that much of this should be left to the individual states. I'm not sure that standardized animal cruelty laws coming out of the federal government will do the job quite as well as getting it done at the state. And frankly, I think Hawaii can move a lot faster and farther than the feds in this area if it decides to.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you, Barbara. Does that answer your question?
Well, yes. I just also wanted to know specifically about the foie gras. Would you be willing to help, like in California, Governor Schwarzenegger passed a law to make it illegal. Do you think Hawaii has a chance of doing that?
I apologize that I don't know enough about what the current status of the Hawaii legislature's discussions on that specific issue are. I wouldn't at all doubt that our state legislature could in fact consider and possibly pass such a law, and I certainly think it should be debated and addressed.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you, Barbara.
Thank you.
All righty. Yeah, as you can see, many issues out here with animal issues, and in fact, you did do quite a bit with the invasive species, and that's why I had dealt with your office and your people there. Quite a bit of changes came about with that, and it's going to involve money. It's going to involve a strict enforcement, and there, as you mentioned earlier, so many agencies stepping over one another in the soup, and maybe the remedy, there needs to be a stronger law, but a stronger national law. They attempted to do that, but it was, I describe it as nonsensical, and we discussed it on the show, but I think you know firsthand what we need here.
Well,
that would be helped.
The bill that was referenced coming out of Representative Abercrombie was actually a further development of a bill that I developed when I was in the U.S. Congress. And the bill came out of this very, very simple question.
Mm-hmm.
If California can inspect our baggage for agricultural products going into California, why can't we inspect bags coming into Hawaii from California?
Mm-hmm.
With all great respect to people everywhere, I suppose, the honor system doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to have, in order to prevent, the real problem with invasive species here in Hawaii is not what you do with them after they get there, it's what you do to prevent them from coming in to start
mm-hmm.
with. California invests an incredible amount of money to assure that the fruit fly doesn't come from Hawaii into Central California, and that's why we all have to have our bags inspected by the U.S. Department of Agriculture when we go up to the mainland.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't have to have, nobody has to get their bags inspected to come into Hawaii. Yet we're far more vulnerable as a state, as an island ecosystem, to invasive species, frankly, than the mainland is or anywhere else. But we don't have the power to do that. So essentially what my bill said was, give Hawaii the power to inspect. coming in so that we can prevent these invasive species from coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a bureaucratic nightmare to start to unwind. I think I got pretty close, but I ran out of time,
Yeah. Unfortunately.
So, you know, sometimes people ask me what are the areas that I might pick up with when I get back. Well, that's one very, very specific one is invasive species coming into Hawaii, preventing them from coming.
Yeah, because, as you say, the honor system and having worked and lived in California, even the state borders on the highways, there is an agricultural checkpoint. You come here, there is a form you fill out, and you don't have to fill it out. You can lie and give a false name, and do you have any animals or reptiles or whatever? No.
You can even do it, you know, as a law-abiding citizen. You fill it out. You don't think something is illegal, but, you know, there it is. And it isn't as if this idea is not already tested. One of the things that I always believe in doing when you solve problems is to see whether somebody else faced the problem and whether they already did a solution. And come to discover, for example, that New Zealand, a country very, very much like our state in terms of its ecosystems,
right.
An island country, very susceptible to invasives because it has its own unique ecosystem, mm-hmm. from being isolated for all those billions of years. They do an excellent job of inspecting when you come in, of screening, and they have dramatically reduced their invasive species invasion into New Zealand.
They have an aggressive
and
program.
It's not expensive. It's not a hassle. You don't think about it when you go.
Mm-hmm. So you would get in and go back there, and that would be one.
I'd want to go back there. Yeah, I mean, and you know, again, Representative Abercrombie is carrying the torch and on this, and I think we've got to, with him coming home, somebody's got to go carry it.
Yeah.
To the next legs.
They should revisit that bill, but a lot of things in there haven't worked for the federal government in knowing the inspection capacity and what it could have been done a little better and a little more consenting or consulting of the public, and that was a problem. But one of the things that I want to talk to you about, what do you have in plans or ideas about helping those senior citizens and also the homeless? But for right now, we have Kate on the phone. This is Carol Cox Show, 524-1080. You can,
good morning.
If you have any questions. Good morning, Kate. How are you?
Yes, hi. Very good show, and I appreciate Kate being on. I'm just as shocked about the advertiser poll, feeling that Hanabusa seems to be, heavy with the old boys. But I'd like to just comment about his comments on the economy and my feeling that the old boy network is the last to fall, and wondering what maybe he might do to show us that he's different. Abercrombie surely was not one of, he changed his stripes because it's a powerful position and everybody likes that and likes to be there, but I don't think he was very effective. And I'm hoping things will change because we're in for a rough ride. And hopefully, I'd like to know if he's going to try to awaken the populace that they need to know that this didn't happen in a vacuum, and what we can do about it to get ourselves ready for, the surely impending economic disaster. So I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thank you, Kate.
Well, I don't think anybody would accuse me, Kate, of being an old boy. That kind of hasn't been my approach to politics throughout my time in it. I believe that centralizations of power are not good for democracy. I believe that power does tend to corrupt, and I believe that power, once it's in power, is not going to give it up. And I believe that we have this... many power structures start out with good, idealistic, well-motivated beliefs that truly represent the people, and somehow, some way, it seems to be an immutable law of human nature that once you get in, once you centralize, you just ain't going to give it up, and it turns in a different direction. And I have believed for many, many years now that our politics in Hawaii has fit that profile, and I have believed that we needed to inject new blood, a broader perspective, a better representation, to apply a better check and balance on that so-called old boy network, my campaigns in one way or another have always been about that. They have been about a better government, a better way forward. And I believe that that is and can be true on a national level as well. So in all honesty and kind of without being facetious in answering your question, the best thing I can do to try to provide that check and balance is to run and be elected. Because when somebody like me is elected despite the old boys' preferences, that's a stake to the system. That's a change. And I only wish and hope that many more candidates will get out there and basically say the same kinds of things. We are going to need to open this government up in Hawaii and in our federal system in order to accomplish reasonable adjustments to prepare for the future. Centralizations of power don't tend to look to the future. They tend to be rooted in the past and in the maintenance of the past. And that's true here, and it's been true nationally. And we need to change that because we need new ideas. We need a better way forward for all of these areas. And that's really fundamentally what my candidacies have been about.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you. We have these two wars going on. And I don't want to go without asking a basic question. Could you share with us or the public your stance on this, the current issues, and knowing that you're outside now, but upon arrival when you put on that suit and tie, and I don't know how easy that's going to be to put another tie on and a suit.
I've been very, very happy not having to put on coats and ties, and that's if I am reelected, I can categorically say that's going to be the worst thing that happens.
But asking that, what do you think, or what's your views or your stance, or what will you bring to the table on the issues of the war and support for the president, the current president, Obama? And if you would, share with the public.
Well, you asked, first of all, you said two wars, and I want to be sure that we're talking about the same wars, because, you know, I would say that we are engaged in a number of wars. Clearly, we are still in a war in Iraq, and we are in a very, very difficult and increasingly tragic war in Afghanistan. And I don't also want anybody to forget that we are, in fact, still in a war of sorts against international terrorism. That has not gone away. That is not somehow just you know sparked into nothingness. It's still out there, and we have to deal with it, and that is happening. I generally believe that President Obama is on the right track in both Iraq and Afghanistan. I believed that Iraq turned out to be a mistake, and I also believed that, having said that we needed to stabilize an exit from Iraq in a very reasoned and deliberate way rather than just kind of recklessly. And so I opposed, artificial early unilateral withdrawals, and in fact, that has been what has happened. That has been the policy that President Obama has followed, and I think we have left that country about as good as we can, and it's time for us to withdraw reasonably. And I think we're doing that. So that's Iraq. Afghanistan is an incredibly tough decision because Afghanistan, as the president rightly said, was a war of necessity, not a war of choice. We had to go into Afghanistan because that's where we were struck from, and if we didn't change that, we were going to get struck again. And the mistake we made earlier was in not getting in there and taking care of the growth of Al-Qaeda under the Taliban in Afghanistan. So that hasn't changed. I mean, if we just kind of yank out of Afghanistan right now, I don't have too much doubt that we will see kind of a movement back to what existed before we were struck on September 11th. We'll have the Taliban starting to take power. We'll have a safe haven for Al-Qaeda, and we cannot allow that to happen. Now, the question then is, okay, if that's our goal, then how can we accomplish it without getting bogged down like the Soviets did or the British did for years and even decades? And that is the incredible challenge that President Obama faces right now. And I believe that he will come to the conclusion that we can't unilaterally withdraw, but we cannot simply go on forever. We have to have a measured strategy, a rethinking of our strategy that is focused very much on making sure that when we do leave, that Afghanistan does not again harbor Al-Qaeda, does not again descend into a government that terrorizes its people and internationally. And by the way, to make things worse, Afghanistan is half the problem. The problem is also Pakistan, which is a huge problem next door. because I don't think we have really reached an understanding, if I can put it that way, internationally, not just the United States, because NATO is in Afghanistan. We're not alone in Afghanistan. We became alone in Iraq. We're not alone in Afghanistan. This is a joint enterprise by a lot of countries around the world. But we have not yet internationally reached a common set of beliefs and undertakings with Pakistan to avoid essentially the same situation that occurred in Afghanistan and led to us being struck. And we got to be realistic. You ask me, what do I bring to the table? Sometimes I listen to the debate and I think, oh, that's not real. We have to confront reality. We have to confront the fact that people are going to try to attack us if we let them attack us. We have to confront the reality of regimes that just want power and they don't care about people. I mean, that's unfortunately the world. And we can try to change it, and we should try to change it, but we still have to deal with it today.
So what would your stance be on our friends? Take, for example, I often hear Israel is going to attack. Does that interfere with our ability to deal straight with other nations? Because if our friends... And I'd like to ask, as a congressman, would you go and ask these questions? We're talking about Iran not having or acquiring the bomb. As a congressman, would you have any difficulty in asking Israel, where did you get your bombs from and will you get rid of them? And can we, I mean, if we're looking for world peace, and I think if you could speak to that.
Well, first of all, I think we do need denuclearization internationally, and we have gone a fair ways in this direction. I would say that in some ways we're better off than we were 10 or 20 years ago, mm-hmm. when you know we and the U.S. former USSR just had incredible, you know, stockpiles of bombs, far more than needed to wipe everybody out. So
right.
You know, what's the point of that? On the other hand, I think it's unavoidable. That we do not want North Korea to get any further atomic weapons, whatever it has already, and we do not want Iran. Why? What is the why of that? The why of that is because these are nations and regimes and governments that essentially say they want to go out there and, you know, attack other countries, and I think that's pretty tough. It's pretty tough to say, yeah, okay, Iran, you can want to wipe other countries that are recognized by the United Nations off the map, but, you know, we'll let you have your bomb. I don't think that works too well. I do believe that Israel shouldn't be saying we're going to attack Iran. So let me be clear about that. I think that interferes with the work at hand for us. I think, you know, from an Israel perspective, you want to tell them, hey, shut up. Let's get the, you know, we need to get this job done. We know what your concerns are, but we've got to work internationally.
Right.
And so I really support the effort that President Obama and others are pursuing now for a much tougher set of sanctions against Iran. It's tough to get China on board and Russia on board. They've got other interests, but that's what we got to do.
Yeah. Boy, it's I don't envy you. And you're wanting to step in and back in it. And these are some trying times. But, you know, my hat's off to you. And senior citizens, what can relief can you bring to them tax-wise, medical-wise? And I ask that because as I look at myself in the mirror, I'm no longer a young fellow anymore. And I'm hearing quite a bit from seniors. What have you given any thought, and what would you arrive with in looking for solutions to those?
Absolutely. Let me say that there are a host of issues facing our senior citizens, from medical care to housing to deterioration and pension of funds, to property taxes, which is obviously a city issue, but it's impacted by state and federal issues. And let's also face the fact that the fastest growing segment of our population are senior citizens. We are not a young society, as they say. We're not, you know, our demographics are, that bulge, that baby boomer bulge is moving into the senior citizen gang now, and we don't have more people underneath it to take care of the payments.
Mm-hmm.
That's a problem that many developed countries like Japan and Germany and Italy, Britain, all have. The biggest issue for seniors in the next 10 years, by far, is Medicare and maintaining Medicare. And Medicare is unsustainable right now, and it's getting worse. And I could go on for another hour about why that is, but in essence, it is because it's a pay-as-you-go system, because income has to take care of expenses,
right?
And because expenses are growing faster than income is growing for Medicare. And those lines are crossing in the next 5 to 7 years. So in other words, in the next 5 to 7 years, if it hasn't already happened, the expenses of Medicare every year are greater than the income to support Medicare. And therefore, it becomes an incredible drain on the federal budget. It is not paying as you go.
Mm-hmm.
And again, to be very direct without getting into the details,
mm-hmm.
in budgets, there's only two ways to balance budgets. You either you've got to reduce expenses or curb growth in expenses or increase income. There's only two ways, or
right.
some combination. We haven't balanced Medicare, and we've got some incredibly tough choices on cost containment on the one hand and on income enhancement on the other. Two items that nobody wants to do. And so therefore, what does Congress do and the President do? Kick the can down the road and say everything's okay. Well, it's not okay. We're out of time. So I will tell you very honestly that from a senior citizen perspective, I think the number one thing I can do for our seniors next year and 10 years from now is to get Medicare back on a sustainable track, because that's key to our seniors.
So and that would be one of your things that you would arrive fighting, kicking, and scratching for.
Arrive fighting, kicking, and scratching, and I don't have to educate myself as to what the problem is.
Because you've been there.
Been there, done that.
And then, so that would be a plus for us, obviously.
I think so, but that's up to the voters.
Yeah, you got to listen to some of the calls sometimes and the comments I get out on the street. They're sharp. I mean, very sharp, you know, like Kate and others ask. But anyway, anything else? Just quickly, the homeless. You have anything, any insight or any hope or any ideas when you arrive, if you get back to Congress?
Well, I think the homeless is obviously an incredible challenge that we all have at every level of government, federal, state, and local government. I think from a federal perspective, what we can do the most for the homeless is to get an economy rolling again, number one. And then number two, of course, to take care of the root causes of homelessness. And the root causes of homelessness, I think we know now, are not just poverty. They are a physiological and psychological illness, many times drug abuse. And those are obviously areas where our government does have a role to try to prevent it from happening for starters and then develop effective programs. But the number one thing we have to do from the perspective of our homeless is to attack the conditions under which people do become homeless, which are primarily still economic. If you don't have money, it's hard to maintain a home.
Anyway, real quickly, you have a website, and can you give that right quick and for people to contact if they have questions or comments?
Sure, I appreciate that. My website is www.edcase.com, edcase.com. And if you go to that website, you will be able to reach me very, very quickly. I answer all my emails myself. I consider it a form of talk story town meeting. So please go there. I welcome people to come there and join up on the campaign if you want, but for sure communicate.
All righty. Well, I want to thank you, Mr. Ed Case, congressional candidate for the second district. Or
first congressional.
First congressional.
Honolulu, Hawaii Kai to Mililani.
Okay. Well, thank you for joining us, and feel free to come back again. And thank you for joining us. This is the Carol Cox Show. Aloha.
This is KWAI, Honolulu, 1080 on the AM dial.